Testing, testing. This is an interview for the Brickyard Workers Oral History Project at the Museum LA. The date is February 11th, 2009, and I'm at the home of Joe Maley in Auburn, Maine, and this is Andrea Lumgia. Joe, could you just start by giving me your full name?
It's Joseph Maley.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in Brunswick, Maine. In 1964.
And did you grow up in Brunswick?
No, I grew up mostly in Lewiston, Auburn.
And what were your parents' names?
Hester and Duke Maley.
And how many children were there in your family growing up?
We had a family of four.
So two kids and the parents, or four kids?
Four kids in all.
Okay. Yeah. So what part of Lewiston, Auburn did you live in?
I lived on Beer Street, which is right down the street from here, when I was a little kid. And then I lived on Knox Street for a few years in my teen years. And then we moved back to Auburn, right across the street from Beale's Laundry, in a building that's no longer there. And then I stayed in Auburn from then.
Yeah. What was Auburn and Lewiston like when you were growing up?
It
was in the
60s
and
70s. Mostly the 70s. 70s,
yeah.
Geez, what was it like?
In terms of what you see today, how is it different?
Well, it was definitely a lot less crime-ridden. It was, Lewiston was still rough, but it was different. It was a different kind of rough. I mean, you had to go looking for trouble a lot of times. Nowadays, you don't even have to go looking for it. It finds you.
Yeah.
As far as Auburn is still Auburn. It's quiet for the most part, and, you know.
Yeah. What, did you have, were you in a neighborhood with lots of kids around?
Yeah. We used to play down at Webster School a lot. My mom, she was always good about letting us stay out, especially in the summertime. So, you know, we used to play basketball and kickball. That was big back then. Dodgeball, God forbid. I think there's a lot of scarred kids now because of dodgeball. But yeah, we played, we rode our bikes around. But most of us generally stayed right in the neighborhood where we were brought up. So.
Yeah. And what did your parents do for work?
My mom worked at local heel shops, and it was my stepfather, and he was a welder, and he worked at various places.
Yeah. In the community at that time, did you, did religion play a big part in growing up?
No.
Yeah.
No.
So it was the social aspect of that you can't do today, just sort of run around in the neighborhood and be with your friends, that's not the same.
It's not the same. I mean, even when my son was 14, I asked him, was complaining to me one day on how he was bored, and I said, well, why don't you and your friends go out and build a cabin? And he looked at me like I was a spaceman or something. It's like, what's a cabin? They just don't do that stuff anymore.
Yeah.
I'd buy him a bike, and he didn't even want to ride that around. He's just happy playing video games and being on the computer and stuff, so.
I'm interested to know if, during your growing up, the downtown Lewiston area was still vibrant, or had that moved away?
No, I remember, I remember Kresge's and the, I can't remember the name of the hardware store that's in the, I think it's the courthouse now. Is that the same building? I can't remember, I think it is. But anyway, that was a busy place, because that was before the malls, or, Zaire's Mall was there. Bradley's Mall was there, but there was still a lot of downtown. You know, I remember all the stores down there, and it was different.
Yeah. Was Peck still there?
Yes. No. Peck's was empty. As far as I can remember back, Peck's was empty.
Yeah.
Now,
at what age did you start working in the brickyards, or how did that come to be?
Well, I was working, I remember when I was 6 years old, I was living over at Bisson's Market in Lewiston on Lisbon Street, and I wanted to make chocolate. He used to have these big chunks of chocolate, and in order to get the big chunks of chocolate, I had to shovel the porch. There was a community porch in on the building upstairs. And he told me, he said, you shovel that and give you chocolate. And I always had chocolate in the wintertime. I would help the next door neighbor. Him and his wife owned a couple apartment buildings, and I would help them paint, or what I thought was helping. I don't know how much of a help can a 6-7-year-old be, but
oh, that young.
You know. Oh yeah. I mean, when I was 6 years old, I was playing on Lisbon Street around where the drunks were on the bars, because that was back when the bars were. That strip was nothing but bar rooms.
Right.
And I was down in there, and but then, you know, as I got a little bit older, I started carrying newspapers. And then when I turned 15, I really wanted a job. So I went to work at Mom and Dad's Car Wash. I did that for one winter. And then I started working at the Sun Journal in the mailroom.
Well, where did you get your work ethic, all these jobs at such a young age? Was it part of coming out of your family?
No, I think it was, it was a result of my family. I wanted to be out of the house as much as possible. It was a working class family that had a lot of issues, social issues, and I just wanted to be
working
away from them.
Yeah.
So I chose to work, but I did. I think I learned a lot from my mom, though. In that, I remember her going to, because she'd go to the, work at a heel shop, sicker than a dog, because she was worried for her job. She was always saying, she got to be there every day, got to make the boss happy, and, So I picked up a lot of that ethic, but not all of it, because now if I'm sick, I don't work. I'm different that way, but, I worked at the Sun Journal, and then when I turned 18, I needed full-time employment. They didn't have any at the time, so I wound up going to Enterprise Foundry over on South Avenue, and I talked to the gentleman. Well, first I had filled out some applications into all the mills.
Oh, yes.
And to this day, I'll never forget it, I went into Libby Mill, and the woman told me, after interviewing me, she said, well, I'm sorry, but I just don't think you're mill material. And to this day, almost 30 years later, I'm not quite sure what she meant, but in a way, if I ever got to meet her, I think I'd have to thank her. Because as I grew, I found that once you get in that mill environment, it was very difficult to get out.
Did you have friends that worked at the mill?
No, I didn't know anybody that worked in the mills. At that time, the biggest places to go to work was like Clark Shoe, and a lot of the people were working up at like DeCoster's and things like that. I didn't really know that many people that were really into full-time real employment yet. But then when I went to Enterprise Foundry, I was in that catch-22 deal in the sense that, well, you don't have the experience. And I told the guy, I'm only 18 years old. Well, if I can't work, how do I get the experience? To get the experience to come to work for yourself. But he brought me on, and it was back-breaking work.
What kind of work was it?
I started off on weights and jackets, what they call weights and jackets. It's a metal foundry. They pour casting. So you put these big, heavy jackets around the molds, and then you put weights on top of them. So when they pour the iron, the mold itself doesn't collapse from the weight of the iron. Then I moved into the grinding room, then finally into the core room. And then I left there in 1986 because of the financial situation. I started out at making $4.25 an hour. About 2 years later, I was only making $4.75 an hour. I was able to get into the brickyard at, I think it was like $7 or $8 an hour for piecework, bundling brick. And that's where I spent the next 9 years.
Wow. And so that was that year-round or...
Yes, while I was there, it was year-round. They had just as I started there, they were bringing in what they call the water struck, the old hand-molded brick process inside a building. They had mechanized it, so it was all under a roof in a semi-climate-controlled environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't go out of their way to heat the building. The only source of heat in the winter was the kiln. So you get about 30 feet from the kiln, you were cold. You know, you stand in front of the kiln, you were hot. Or if you were on top of the kiln, you were hot.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the process that you were involved in, the bundling. Is that what you did the whole time you were
there? No, I did quite a few different things there. Bundling, basically, they had the bricks. They would set what they call set the brick. The brick would come out of the extruder and through the wire cutter, and people would set them on what they call cars. And I think it was like 4,320 brick per car. And they would go through the drying. After the car was filled, it would go through the drying cycle, and which would take a day or two. And then it would go through the kiln system, another day, 2 days, 2.5 days, depending on how fast they were going. And then they were ready to be bundled. And basically what you would do is you'd take the fired brick off from the cars, have to sort them, have to get rid of the garbage brick. We call them brick bats, B-A-T-S. And you throw them up on a conveyor belt that would take them out, dump them in a dump truck. And you take the good brick and you put them in what we call the cube. And it was 528 brick per cube. And it was a standard way of building them so a forklift could pick them up. And you'd do your cube and then you'd strap it and send it down a little conveyor and then it would go outside. And then the forklift would come by and pick them up and put them on a truck or put them in the piles. You know.
And off they go.
Yep.
And they were ready to go.
Yeah. And that was extremely hard work, physically demanding. A lot of times the mentality was strong back, weak mind. The weaker the mind, the better. Because anybody with any real intelligence really wouldn't want to do that type of job all too long. Because it was physically demanding. At one point, I was the fastest bundler. And I could bundle anywhere between 25 to 35 cubes in an 8-hour day. And when you start thinking about, you know, there's 528 brick per cube, each brick weighs approximately 3 pounds, you're moving some serious tonnage. And that's not including the brick that you're bending down to pick up to throw on the belt.
Right.
And you'd do this, you know, you'd have a break at 9:30, I think it was, and then you'd have your lunch, and then you'd, you know, and it didn't matter if it was 90 degrees out or 20 below, you had to do it, you know. Very physically demanding.
And how did you do it? Because I'm speaking to you, you're very intelligent. And how did you separate the physical from the other?
Back then, you might have to edit this, but back then the big thing was the bundlers and the setters, most of the younger guys, at break, before work, at break, at lunch, would have beer, would smoke pot, whatever it took to get them through. And management was well aware of it, but they didn't really, they didn't go out of their way to stop it, because they had a basic understanding of what they were dealing with. As a general rule for the manpower that they had.
Right.
They knew that the guys were going out back at break in the shed smoking dope.
Yeah.
You know, as long as they were back when the pug started up, you know, they more or less turned a blind eye. In retrospect, I mean, I look at it as being, you know, that's corporate America for you. They didn't care about their employees. They just cared about their product. And it was a rough group, I mean, and like I said earlier, it was a strong back, weak mind situation, so you really, as a general rule, you didn't really have a lot of the cream of the crop, per se, of the workforce. You had a lot of the dredges of the workforce, transients, people that couldn't hold a job in any other environment, just because of their basic attitudes or whatever, but they could move brick, or they, you know.
Yeah. Was there a lot of turnover?
Yes.
And this was more in Brickyard, right?
Yes, down here in Danville. Extremely large turnover, especially on the bundling side. The setting side, they had a turnover rate, but it wasn't nearly as bad as the bundling side. Just the nature of the way the bundling went, it was a... Once you started, you didn't have to stop. Very seldom did you have to stop to wait for a machine breakdown or something. opposite of what the setters had to deal with. They, you know, the puck broke down, or the clay wasn't coming in correct, or you know, if the clay wasn't right, it would still be running, but they just, the guy at the end of the line would throw in a dumpster because it weren't good brick to set. Their work was physically demanding, but they had some, a lot of downtimes in between, so they could stretch their backs and whatever. Mm-hmm. With the bundlers, it was a lot tougher, in my opinion. I ran the bundling crew when I came back from Saudi in 91, and yeah. It was incredible. I mean, we would hire four or five guys in the morning, and by coffee, if you had one of them left, you'd be lucky. I mean, the old saying was, well, I got to go to the bathroom. Well, the bathroom was over here to the right, and you'd see him walking to the left because that's where the door was. And it was hilarious. I mean, I would say to guys, don't forget your lunchbox, because it just became so
a pattern.
Business, yeah, business as usual.
Yeah.
And you know, just to give you an example of some of the mentality of some of the people that were working there, and I'll never forget it. I had come out of rehab, and in 93, 94, and I was still running the brick line, and kid come up to me, we just hired him like a week before that, and he come up, he says, Joe, I heard you used to smoke dope. I says, yeah, I used to. He says, I got a whole new respect for you. And it was at that point that I really knew that I was going nowhere working at Warren Brickyard. It's like, okay. I mean, at that time, you know, I had been to Saudi Arabia, I'd been to Honduras through the military. I was in there early 30s at that point, and you know, I had run the brick kiln for about 2 years, and well, this isn't working.
So where did you go after that?
After I left there, I joined the Sheet Metal Workers Union, which I'm still a member right now, even though I'm not working.
Now I have some questions. Like, you talked briefly about the management at the brickyard. Were there people in management, or what were they like overall to work with?
Well, the plant manager, the general manager, Norm Davis, he was a businessman. He was a businessman. That's he was there to get brick made and packaged and sold, and that's his, at the cheapest possible cost, right, wrong, or indifferent. He was a no-nonsense type of person. He had the sense of humor of a rat sometimes. But then he had the plant manager, Gene Roy, very intelligent man. I learned so much from that man.
Is he still living?
Yeah, and as far as I know, he's still working there. He's very articulate. We had our run-ins with each other, but overall, I learned a lot from him. But again, he was brought up the old school. He worked the water struck system when it was outside. He worked his way up through the ranks. But he had the sense of getting the most out of a person that he could, mm-hmm. for the least that he could. That was his job, as well as keeping the plant going. Even though he wasn't a licensed electrician, he did a lot of the electrical work there because he had a good working past. He had a good past knowledge of electricity through the military, mm-hmm. and stuff. So, and then it was Armin Turcotte, who was the maintenance head of the extruder side of the system, but he was also the maintenance guy. He was the guy that was, he's only like 5'5" tall, but 5 foot wide. You know, he's a bulky guy and hard worker, and he knows his crap when it comes to mechanical things. Very intelligent person in what he does. But the way he talked to a lot of the guys, he really knew how to put people down, because, again, it was a situation to where, hey, if you don't like it, leave. That was the attitude. They didn't care, because they knew that they had people waiting. They would always have a stack of applications. So it didn't matter. You know, he would holler at the guys and call them names and the whole nine yards to belittle people. And most of the time, the guys put up with it because either they didn't understand what he was doing, or they were fearful for the job because they knew they had to have some kind of income. There was a couple people that put him on the spot with it, though. He knew who we could pull his crap with and who we couldn't.
What stories did you hear over those years about the way they used to do it in the quote-unquote old days from Gene or others?
Oh, extremely hard work. They'd start in sun up, and they would work the water struck. They apparently what they did is they would make the water struck brick, and they had these long wooden sheds. And when I say long, I'm talking a couple hundred feet long, probably, I don't know, 12, 15 feet tall, if I remember right. And it was just rows of them, and they would put the mud into molds, or the clay, whatever they wanted to call it, and they would put them on plates, and then they'd put them on racks, and then they'd fill these racks up and put them in the sheds, and they would dry them. It was all air dried then. And then after they were dried, they would actually take the brick, and they would stack them up and then build a wooden encasement around it and fire it. That's how they dried their brick. And that was before they had the kiln system in.
Yeah.
And that's how they fired their brick. Mm-hmm. And it was, from what I understand, we had it lucky compared to what they had to do. In a way, I kind of wished I could have seen that type of operation.
I've seen pictures of the men out there in May in bathing suits in the clay pits, and you can only imagine how different that was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even when they brought the mechanics inside, the setters were allowed to wear shorts and stuff, only because of the heat. You know, they would stand. Well, the way the system was set up is the end of the kiln was pretty much directly in front of where the setters were working, so they always had this blast of hot air coming at them. And if it's 90 degrees out and you got this blast of hot air coming from your backside, it wears you out real fast. The stories, though. I've heard a lot of the stories about how hard the work really was then. But again, even back then it was a strong back, weak mind mentality.
Are there others that you've worked with that worked for a significant time or worked during the old system that you knew there that you think we should talk to or you have recollections of?
Yeah, actually there's a guy named Woody. He lives right over here on James Street as far as I know. He's been there forever.
And he's still there?
Yeah, yeah. There's Gene Roy. There's Armin Turcotte. I can't think of any of the other old-timers that might still be there. I think Robbie Porter is there. Not Robbie, but... Yeah, Robbie Porter is there.
So some of them started in the old system and went to the new?
Well, Armin and Gene and Woody, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's Woody's last name?
You would ask me that. I only worked with him for 9 years because his name is always Woody.
Oh. That's okay.
If I didn't want to think of his name, I'd think of his real name right now, too.
I can find it out some other way.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Norm Davis would know, yeah.
Yeah. What is it that I haven't asked you about the brickyards that you think that we should add in talking about this and getting the history?
Good question.
Because I figure you know more about your experience, and I may not ask all the questions that are pertinent.
As far as the history goes, like I said, when I started there, they were just bringing everything inside. Mm-hmm. Moore and Brick originally weren't where it is now. It was down on, I think it was Brickyard Circle.
Circle, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm not privy to that history part. There's a lot of the history that I'm just not privy to because I know Rachel asked me last week, like, how did they build these buildings? And a lot of times, my understanding was, from talking to some of the old-timers, is when they would build a place like Bates Mill, they would actually go in and build a little brickyard right there. What they would do is they would bring their clay in, the clay and sand and stuff that they needed to make the brick, but everything would be right there on site because of the logistics situation back then and the sheer volume of brick. I mean, you're talking, when I was working at Moore & Brick, they were putting out, I think it was like 250,000 bricks a year or something. No, it was 250,000 brick a week. And when you look at the size of a building like Bates Mill, and this is all mechanicalized now, there's no way that they could do that back then. So what they do is they do it on site, and as the bricks were dried and cured and fired, they would install them. Trying to think of any other. I can't think of anything.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.